Okay, and now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Mike from Coronado.
My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the group for asking me to speak here tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in my own recovery. If I don't share anything else with you tonight, I want to share this, and that is that the most important thing in my life is the fact that I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing in my life that is more important than that. What I learned very early on is that for the first time in my life when I came through the doors of AA is that I could have a primary purpose, something that comes before everything else, and that was to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. It's the best deal I've ever had. What I was taught early on is to share in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like today. And so I'll just get into it. By the way, what time do I stop?
I got you.
No, but what time do I stop?
You got 45 minutes.
Okay.
Roughly about 10 of.
About 10 of?
10 of,
yeah. All right. Okay. So I just like to have that in my head. I'm sorry. I grew up in New Jersey, and we didn't get drunk in limousines like the rich people in La Mesa, by the way. It made La Mesa sound like Beverly Hills. I grew up in a nice middle class town. Dad was a school teacher. Mom worked in a doctor's office, and it was just me, and I had a younger brother, and never wanted for anything. There was nothing, you hear about dysfunctional families. There was nothing dysfunctional in my family until I started drinking. It was just a normal, nice place to be raised and grow up. And first time I ever got drunk, I'd gotten permission from my parents to sleep over a friend's house that lived around the corner. And this guy, Charlie, his family were Jewish people. And so I was, and he had a bedroom that was up in like an attic that was turned into a bedroom. And his parents had gone to bed. And up in that, just as you got to the top of the stairs in that attic, was a closet. And in that closet was where his father kept all of the Seder wine and alcohol bottles for their holidays. And so Charlie goes in there and he comes out with this bottle, and it was Four Roses whiskey. And it was one of those crystal decanter kind of bottles with a stopper in the top and, this brown liquid inside of it. And he says, you want to try some of this? It makes you feel good. And I'm thinking, why the hell would I want to do that? And he tips it up and takes a drink and hands it to me. So I look at him and I look at it and I think, well, I'll try it. I took this thing up to my lips, and it was the most foul, horrible tasting. It was like iodine that was on fire. It was coming down the front of me and out of my nose. And Charlie's laughing at me. And I'm thinking to myself, you're fat. Nobody in school likes you. And you're laughing at me. If you can do this, I can do this. So I tilt this thing up, and this time I get a nice plug of that, and it goes down my throat, and it goes down here, and it hits my chest, and it was warm, and it radiated out down into my arms, down to the tips of my fingers, and then it went back up and hit the top of my head, and I drank as much of that as fast as I could, and I'm hearing things like, hey, aren't you going to let me have some? And, hey, are you going to drink the whole thing? And then I'm hearing, hey, where are you going? Well, where I was going was the heck out of there, because I was feeling like I'd never felt before in my life, and I wasn't going to be at some lame guy's house. So I'm hearing a screen door slamming behind me, and I'm running out into the street. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I used to have these dreams that were so vivid that I was flying over the streets. And I could see my block and the school and the trees and everything. And that's the way I felt when I was running down the street with alcohol in me. I felt like every three or four steps I wanted to take my feet off the ground like Peter Pan and go flying up in the air. And so it made me feel like a god. That was the first lesson that I had from alcohol, is alcohol made me feel like a god. And then I got about halfway around the block, and I drank about half a bottle of this stuff, and I had to pee. And, well, when you gotta pee, you just pee. So I peed right on the sidewalk, which was the next lesson that I learned about alcohol, is when I'm drinking, I behave like a pig. I mean, I don't care. You know, right in front of God and everybody, I was just gonna pee right on the street. And then I got to my block, which is a little dead-end street, and I go running down to my house, and I walk in the front door, and my father's sitting in his chair right inside. He was always in that chair. He's always doing the same thing, reading a book. And he looks up from his book over his glasses, and he looks back down, and he says, I thought you were sleeping over your friend's house. I said, yeah, I was, but it was boring, so I came home. He says, oh, okay, well, go on up to bed. Okay, so I get up to the stairs, and I walk up to the top of the stairs, and I'm by my bedroom, and I start thinking about this. And I think, you know, he didn't even pay attention to me. In fact, he never pays attention to me. In fact, all he does is pay attention to my brother. He never does anything with me. When you come right down to it, he's not a very good father. Which would have been fine, except I went back down there and I told him all those things. Then he looked up from his book and said, Michael, have you been drinking? And I said, no. And he says, well, go on upstairs. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Now, this started, I was like 16. This started me on a path, which is, I had to find people that liked to do this. And because I didn't know who my friends were yet. And this began a pattern that was going to go on throughout the rest of my drinking career, which is no matter where I was in high school, whether I was in the band or on the track team, I didn't know who my friends were until the subject of alcohol came up. And when I found out the guys that liked to drink, that's who I wanted to hang around with. And this was true even later. It was true in college. It was true in the Navy. Which is a good thing, because it was true in AA, too. Because the very people, the only people that I ever wanted to hang around with are sitting right here in this room. It's a bunch of drunks. You're my people, and it's the reason why no matter where I've been, around the country, around the world, if I walk into the room, a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know when in July I'm going to go to that Detroit convention, and there's going to be tens of thousands of us. I know that I'm going to be with my people. because we laugh at the same sideways, cockeyed things that the non-alcoholics look at us like we're crazy, and we think is funny as hell. So my drinking progressed. You know, I started getting in trouble in the band. I started getting in trouble on the track team. I was drinking up at track meets after my race was over, and it started coming to the attention of people in school. My parents would be, grounding me. I was drinking their booze. But then it came time to go off to college, and my mother, like I said, worked for a doctor's office, and all her money went to pay for me to get a college education at the College of William and Mary. We went down and visited Williamsburg, Virginia. My mother loved Colonial Williamsburg, and so they sent me from New Jersey down to Williamsburg to go to William and Mary. And a great school, and got down there, and it was absolute freedom under law. Nobody knew me down there. The only problem was I didn't have much money because they gave me an allowance and all my meals were paid for. I ate at a cafeteria on campus. So how much spending money do you need reasonably, you know? Buy a pack of gum or something like that? No, I needed drinking money. And it was not easy to come up with it. And the little bit of money that they gave me didn't go very far. So, you know, I had to be creative. Instead of drinking like people that drink in limousines, I drank the cheapest, crappiest stuff that you could find. I didn't drink Budweiser. I drank Busch Bavarian. I didn't drink Miller High Life, I drank Old Milwaukee. And if they'd had those cans that I saw years later in the supermarket that were just a white can that said in black letters beer on it, I would have bought that. But even buying the cheapest stuff that I could get my hands on, I didn't have enough drinking money. So this guy in the dormitory says to me, "I know a place we can get some money to get something to drink." I said, "Really? Where?" He goes, "Come with me. Don't worry. Just come with me." So we get on a school bus, and our dormitory is like off campus, and you have to stop at this big strip mall before you get onto the college campus. So he says, "Come on, we're getting off here." We get off at this strip mall. And he's walking me up to this building. And there's all these like wino-looking guys standing out in front of this building. And I'm thinking, where the heck is he taking me? And the guy's talking to these winos and he's saying, "No, Charlie, you can't come in here. You were just in here yesterday and it's too soon to come back." And I look up and there's this big sign and it says Plasma Center. What the heck is a plasma center? Well, I very quickly found out a plasma center is this neat place where you go in, they lay you down on a gurney, they put a needle in your arm, they take your whole blood out, and they spin it, and they separate the whole blood from the plasma. They want the plasma. And then what they do is they mix your whole blood in this bag with a saline solution, and then they pump that back into you because you need that. And then they give you $15. So I'm laying there, and me and my college buddy next to me, and there's a few other college students in there, and then across from us is these winos. And I'm looking at these drunken, derelict bums across from me. And what's running through my head is, "You poor bastards, look what your life has come to. You're in here selling your blood so that you can drink." So we get out of there, and the guy gives me my $15, and he says, "Now, you're going to be weak he says, so you really need to go have a very good meal now. You need to have, go get a steak dinner or something like that to get your strength back. Steak dinner, are you out of your mind? That wasn't the point of this. So we go into the Alpha Beta next door, and I get a jug this big of Gallo Rhine wine. And that had me set for, the weekend. Again, they may not drink that in La Mesa, but but that's what we drank. So that's the way it went in college. I didn't know why I wasn't fitting in college. I just didn't feel comfortable in my own skin, like somebody shared earlier. I was nervous, and I didn't fit in, and so I wanted to get out of school as fast as I could. I just wasn't getting along with people. Joined a fraternity, quit the fraternity. Just wasn't having a good time. I just didn't feel right. So I went to summer school a couple of years, and I graduated in 3.5 years. And so I didn't have to do that last spring semester. And some people would think that that was being an overachiever, accomplishing something. But deep down inside, I felt like I was a failure, because deep down inside, I knew that there was something wrong with me, and I just didn't know what the hell that was. And I tried to find a job and tried selling insurance, didn't work, was getting into all kinds of jackpots. Drinking and my drinking was getting increasingly worse, and so one day I walk onto the back porch, and it was my father was sitting out there, and he's reading the newspaper, and I made some real brilliant remark to him. He was a school teacher, so I says, Isn't it great that school teachers only have to work 9 months out of the year, but they get paid for 12? And he looks up from the newspaper and he says, aren't you scared yet? I said, what? He says, aren't you scared yet? I says, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. But I knew exactly what he was talking about, because I'm graduated from the College of William and Mary. I got a bachelor's degree. I don't know what I want to do, and it's like when they handed out instructions on what people are supposed to do in life, I was absent that day, and then something happened that changed my life, a dirty trick if you ask me. My friends told me that they were going to see this movie. And it was over in Hackensack, New Jersey, at the Cinerama movie theater. That's the one with the big screen and the fancy sound system, the Cinerama with Sensoround and all that. It was Midway. Charlton Heston winning World War II in the Pacific. All those guys wearing those khaki uniforms in the Navy, beating the Japanese, and... I'm sitting there and I'm watching this movie, the Doolittle raid on Tokyo, and the whole place is shaking. And I'm thinking to myself, these guys are men. They know what they're supposed to do. If I was in the military, I would know what I was supposed to do. Because they tell you what you're supposed to do. And then that dirty trick happened. I walked out into the lobby as we're leaving, and what was there? Recruiters. So I joined the Navy. I still have the flyer at home someplace. And it's got the Battle of Midway on one side, and on the back it's got the contact information on how to join the Navy. But so I joined the Navy. And my drinking buddies say, let's have one last good drunk. It's like about a week before I'm supposed to go off. I started on April 1st with the Navy in 1977, and it's about a week before that. And so I go over to my friend Richard's house, and we're sitting in his mom's kitchen. His folks are up in bed, and we're sitting down there, and I'm pounding down the beers. And while we're sitting there, looking out the window, there was a late snowstorm. You know, it was a late, it was this March snowstorm. And it came down. And in the course of about 2 hours, it came down like 8 inches, 9 inches of snow. And there were no cars out on the street. Everything outside was covered in snow. It was amazing. I mean, all of the trees and the bushes are covered in snow. If you're from born and raised in California, it's a wonder to behold, you know. And it's so quiet out there. You can hear drops falling out of the trees, and you know, it's beautiful. And so I go out there and I get in my car, and like I said, there was nobody on the road, and I got to drive about a mile home. And so I go down to Main Street and hang a right and go down to the tracks and look both ways. And like I said, there was nobody on the road except this one pickup truck that I sideswiped. And so he gets out of his pickup truck and I get out of my car and he looks and I look. And I look around and I've been drinking a lot. And so he goes back to his truck, and I guess he was going to go get his insurance information or something. And I got back in my car and I took off like a bat out of hell. And I go flying over the tracks and make a left and then up Church Street. And there's a traffic light up there, and I'm sure I didn't stop for it. And went flying down to that dead end I lived down, and went down there and pulled into my driveway and got out and turned around, and it's complete silence. Nobody around. Got away with that one. And go inside. My father's up in bed, so I take his chair and go grab what's in the refrigerator. Was a Michelob. So I cracked a Michelob, and I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking a beer, and then the doorbell rings. And I'm thinking to myself, who would be so rude as to be visiting at this hour? And it was two of Bergenfield, New Jersey's finest standing out on the porch. And I'm thinking, how the hell did they find me? Well, did I say that they hadn't plowed the streets yet? There was nobody on the road. They just followed the tracks. So I had to go down to court. And my mother worked at the doctor's office that was across the street from Borough Hall, and there was a lawyer that worked in the office next to the doctor's office. And she talked to the lawyer, and she says, my son is supposed to be going off to the Navy. They want him to show up with the magistrate on Wednesday. What can he do? And so the lawyer calls me up, and he says, you got $300? I said, yeah. He goes, bring it down my office. And I said, okay. And we go over to the magistrate, and we walk in there, and this truck driver's out in the hall. And the lawyer goes talk to the truck driver, and some money exchanges hands. And then all of a sudden, the truck driver says that I really didn't cause any damage to his vehicle. And so the magistrate, and then the lawyer says to the magistrate that I'm going off to the Navy, and the magistrate dismisses the case. Went home, had some cold duck, and then I'm off to the Navy. So I go to the Navy, and I get up to Newport, Rhode Island, and I'm starting this Navy career over here at Officer Candidate School. And it's, again, absolute freedom under law. Nobody knows me there. And, you know, you go into this boot camp environment, and they start yelling and screaming at everybody. You know, the first week is like a hell week. And all they do is yell and scream and make you do this, do that, wear this, you know. And this is what I was expecting from Midway. You know, it was like, oh, this is great. You know, finally, somebody's telling me what I'm supposed to do. You know, there's guys that are washing out saying, I can't stand all the pressure. I'm thinking, are you nuts? This is great. This is neat. This is like in the movies. And so I start really feeling good. About a week goes by, and then they stop that Hell Week stuff, and then they just start regular routine and marching around and going to classes and stuff. And then 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks goes by, until it's like 6 weeks goes by. And what's happening? Why am I starting to feel good? You know, I put on some beer bloat, and that all evaporated, and I'm feeling like I'm in shape and sharp, and I'm getting 1 week of sobriety, 2 weeks of sobriety, 3 weeks of sobriety, 6 weeks of sobriety. And then they pulled another dirty trick. Why do they keep pulling these dirty tricks? They came up with a thing called liberty. Liberty's where they let you, all this money you've been paid for 6 weeks, they let you go out and you get to spend it someplace. And where did I want to spend it? Well, I didn't know who my friends were in my company up until then. And then I found out who wanted to go drink. And then I found that, gee, I didn't know I liked him. But those were the guys I wanted to hang with. And so we went out and got drunk. And all my life up until this point, and even till today, I loved my country. I wear an American flag lapel pin because I love my flag. It was an honor to me to wear that uniform. When I was a kid, I loved going to see movies about John Wayne, Sands of Iwo Jima. I idolized Patton. And what did I do to honor that? Well, these two or three guys that like to drink the way I like to drink told me that we could go out through the nurse's passageway after we checked back in at 10 o'clock at night, which is when we had to be back. And we could go out and drink until 2 o'clock in the morning. And one of the guys had a cotter pin, and he could rig the door because it was like panic bar doors in the nurse's wing. They were commissioned officers. They could come and go as they pleased. And we rigged their door so that we could get in from the outside. And I started regularly going out with these guys and drink until the bars closed. And one infraction like that, and I would have lost that uniform. Just one. And I was keeping alcohol in my locker in there. When it came to alcohol, I was blind. I'm going to fast forward. And that is, I served in the United States Navy as a surface warfare officer. And at the end of 10 years, I was a lieutenant. I was on my third ship. I was up in Long Beach, California. And I'd had plenty of jackpots. I had a drunk driving arrest that I was able to keep out of the Navy because of a conspiracy with my command and stuff like that. You know, they helped me get a lawyer, and it didn't become an official thing on my record, but it got to a point when I was up in Long Beach where I was up in Liberty up in British Columbia, and I got involved in a Liberty incident, there weren't going to be any more people covering for me. And where did that take me? It took me to sitting in my car in front of a bar up in Long Beach, all by myself. I had moved into an apartment where I hadn't even unpacked the boxes. I didn't have any, just a few mean sticks of furniture in there. Had no food in the refrigerator, just beer. And I was just alone and miserable. And I'm in trouble now, and I don't know what's going to happen with that. And I'm sitting in front of this bar, and this kid goes riding by on a bicycle, and he looked like he was a sailor. And I called out to him. I thought I might have known him or something. And, just some stupid drunken thing that I said. And the guy comes back and he says, "Hey, you're an officer. I can see from your sticker. That's pretty cool." I says, "No, it's not cool." I says, "I'm in trouble. I may be getting kicked out." And then he asked me a funny thing. He says, "Do you have a drinking problem?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I do." And what I'd been saying to myself right before that guy came by is what was one of the first alcoholic prayers, and that was, "I wish there was one person on the face of this earth that I could talk to, because there was no one left that I could talk to." And then that guy came by. Well, it turned out he was sober 60 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had been sober longer. He'd gone through a treatment program, but he had slipped. But he was going to meetings again. He was going to meetings up in Los Angeles at the Pacific Group. But he only had a bicycle. He didn't have a car, and he didn't have a way to get up to the Los Angeles meetings, which he said were the best meetings in AA. And so then what happened was, a few more days went by, and I'm sitting home, and I'm drinking, and I fell asleep, and my phone rang, and it was this kid again, and he asked me if I wanted to talk. And I met him, and we went to a coffee shop, and we talked. And he told me more about Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he says, "You know, you really need to tell." I told him that, you know, that my command was talking about kicking me out. And he says, "You really need to talk to this friend of mine who's a retired first-class bosun's mate that they tried to kick him out, but he asked to go to treatment. And then they couldn't kick him out because he successfully completed treatment." So this guy met with me and my friend Bruce, in the middle of the night. We went to his apartment. He wouldn't even bring us into his apartment. It was one of those old hotels that was turned into apartments, and there was like a lobby with this overstuffed furniture. He was actually wearing a bathrobe when we got there. And that guy talked to me, and what he says is, "You need to go on Monday into the Navy and tell him that you want to tell him you want to go to treatment." But I suggest over the weekend that you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that next night, that was a Saturday, the next night I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, which was Sunday night Ohio Street meeting up in Los Angeles. And I remember we drove up. There was these two guys named Richard, one Big Richard and the other Little Richard, and they were both talking at the same time about pit bulls, neither one of them listening what the other was saying. But as I walked up, something about me got them to stop, and they both shook my hand and welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I went inside, and there was coffee like there is here at this meeting tonight, and I got myself a cup of coffee, and one of you walked up to me and said, "You must be new." And I said, "Really? How do you know?" He says, "Because when we're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we only fill our coffee cups up halfway." You see, my hand was shaking so bad that the coffee was running down my arm. And then I sat down. They had pews instead of chairs at the meeting at that time. And I sat down as the meeting was about to start, and this lady named Marilyn was sitting there and next to me. And she said, "How are you doing?" I says, "I'm not doing well." And she said, "How long have you been sober?" I says, "I haven't been sober, ma'am. I drank yesterday." And she looked at me with the kindest eyes, and she said, "You never have to feel this bad again." She says, "If you don't like what you're getting, just stop doing what you're doing. If you like what you're getting here, keep doing it." She says, "Meet the men in this room and get a meeting schedule and have them circle the meetings that we go to in the Pacific Group. But you never have to feel this bad again, and it's going to get better. Just do what we do." And what they taught me in the first week of meetings that I was going to is just those things. It's, you know, we didn't make any of this up. This is just monkey see, monkey do. It's just one alcoholic helping another alcoholic so that we feel less different and are willing to take actions which don't seem to have anything to do with what I think are my problems. I thought my problem was that I was in trouble with the Navy. That was never my problem. I was the Navy's problem. The Navy wasn't my problem. And so I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. This friend Bruce and I over that first week. And on the eighth day of my sobriety, I got called in. It was a Monday. And I got called in to the ship. And the captain of the ship said, I want you to go down and talk to this Naval Investigative Service guy. And so I went down there and I talked to this guy. And this guy's saying, you know, we got the goods on you. You know, just get honest with us about what you are and what you did. And he says, you don't have to prolong this. He says, if you just tell me, I can have you out of the Navy by the end of the day. You don't even have to go back to that ship. And this guy was a heartless, cruel, mean. He had a skull behind him on the shelf. And I turned to this guy and I said, you don't understand. If I get kicked out of the Navy, I have never finished anything in my entire life. I think if I get kicked out, I'm finished. I don't think I'm going to make it. And something got through to this guy who had no heart, because he wrote this thing up just so ambiguously that later on it made a difference and I didn't get kicked out. But then I get back to the ship and the captain says, okay, well, go on back home and wait, because I was on double secret probation. Why I should show cause not to get kicked out of the Navy with the garbage on the pier. And he says, he got a little twinkle in his eye, and he says, oh, and don't do anything stupid. Now, I knew exactly what he meant. And you don't tell this alcoholic not to do anything stupid. It's my life. If I want to be stupid, I'll be as stupid as I damn please. And I got home, and I had a .38 caliber pistol, and there wasn't going to be a note. I've heard said in rooms of AA that that's how you know it's an alcoholic suicide, and that it's serious, because there's no note. There was no phone calls and no note. And I just sat there, and I cocked that thing, and I put it in my mouth. And at that point, I felt like I was the lowest piece of garbage on the face of the earth. I thought I was human waste. I thought I was like a broken part that needs to be taken off the line and just discarded. I just wanted to rub myself off the face of the earth like I had never been born. And then I said what I've heard from others is the alcoholic prayer. And it was very simple. I just said, God help me. And a bird hit the window behind my head. And I woke up, and I apparently had fallen asleep. That pistol was laying on the coffee table, and I was at what we have been told is the jumping off point. I was at that jumping off place in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I couldn't imagine life with alcohol, and I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And I only had two directions that I could go. I could either pick up that pistol and I could finish what I'd started, or I could reach into my pocket and I could pull out these crumpled pieces of paper and matchbook covers that I'd been accumulating for the last 8 days. What were on those pieces of paper was your phone numbers. And I called this guy Scotty that had talked to me. And when I got him on the phone, he says, are you in a safe place? And I said, no. He says, then get the hell out of there. Get up where the meeting place is. So I drove up to that Ohio Street location and got up there. And it was the most beautiful day that you can imagine. The sun was shining. It's just a gorgeous June Southern California day. And I was at the lowest rung of hell imaginable. And Scotty got up there, and I asked him to sponsor me, and he says, I haven't been sober long enough. He says, but you need to find a sponsor tonight. And I saw that this guy had just shown up, and he was tall, and he was good-looking, and you know, he was very dapper. He was wearing a suit. He'd just come from work, and guys were lining up to shake his hand, and so with the instructions from this guy, Scotty, I got online, and asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he says, well, would you mind telling me your name first? And I says, how long have you been sober? He says, 16 years. So he says, look, if you want me to sponsor you, come Saturday morning to the Penguin Cafe in Venice Beach, and maybe I'll sponsor you. So I stayed sober the rest of the week, and I showed up down there. He looked up, and it was Jim Beam was his name, of all things. And he and this guy, Frank Jones, who some of the older timers know, were there, and they interrogated me. They wanted to know if I'd stolen secrets and given them to the Russians, or if I'd murdered somebody. I said, no, it's just sex stuff. And they said, oh, you'll fit right in the Pacific group. And so then my sponsor, about 2 weeks later, he calls me and he says, you said you'd go to any length, right? I said, yeah. He says, what's your Social Security number? I said, what? Mm-hmm. He goes, just give me your Social Security number. And I give it to him. And then I get a call, and the ship is calling and says, you got to come in. We got a set of orders for you to go to Navy treatment. And so I go in there, and I drive, you know, I get orders. I get to go down to Miramar. I start Navy treatment down there. And my sponsor's a guy named Clancy. Well, this guy Clancy had pulled strings. He got invited to the Navy Alcohol Rehabilitation Center in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, to speak to the whole staff out there. And at the end of the thing, the admiral walks up to him to thank him. And it's Clancy turns on the admiral and says, I don't even know why I came out here. Navy doesn't rehabilitate drunks. And the admiral says, what are you talking about? That's what this whole place is for. He says, oh, really? I got this young puke lieutenant back in Los Angeles, Mike Giorgino, Social Security number 152. You don't let him go to treatment. Then the phone rang in my house. So it just goes to show that God and Clancy and Alcoholics Anonymous are more powerful than the United States Navy. All right. I stayed sober. I successfully completed treatment. I stayed sober 10 more years. I was able to retire from the Navy. I got promoted twice, went to the Gulf War, retired as a surface warfare commander. Then good sponsorship encouraged me to go to law school. I went to law school. I graduated from the University of San Diego. I got to take care of my mother and father as their health declined over recent years. Lost them both about 2 years ago and 4 years ago. But I was there for them. I would have missed it all. I would have missed it all. Now I'm even retired from a job. I was working for the city of San Diego at the city attorney's office for 10 years. I retired from that. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I don't know. Maybe I'll be a limo driver in La Mesa. Just as I got 1 minute left, and I'll just sum it up with this. I started out by saying that the most important thing in my life is that I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 32 and a half years. But if you're applauding, you're applauding for AA, because all I did was keep doing the footwork. And all of those things that I thought about myself and about my life, that it was over, that there was no hope, that I was dirty, that I was no good, that I was damaged beyond repair, they were all lies. And if you're feeling anything like that, just keep coming around here. You know, jump in this thing with both feet because it works. There is a way out, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.